This is a Piccolo podcast production.
Good morning to you. Welcome to another Adam Shand at Large, a special one. I want to use this episode to pay a tribute to my very, very close friend, Brian Francis Murphy, formerly Victoria Police, who passed away at the age of 90 on Anzac Day just yesterday, and I'm going to miss him a lot. I thought I'd tell a story from my book that I wrote with him called The Skull, which most people wouldn't probably know, but it's one that really typifies his character, his heart, and fundamental humanity. Here we go. Shortly after 7 p.m. on the 16th of December 1975, Heidelberg police received a report of gunfire in Hyacinth Street, Greensboro. Ida and Rob Orton were playing cricket in the street with their two kids. They'd set up the wicket in front of their house, 7 Acacia Court, at the top of the cul-de-sac, and the bowler was coming in from the bottom corner at number 1, adjoining Hyacinth Street, where Corporal James David Gardner lived with his wife and two small children. Ida thought she heard someone cracking a stock whip. She'd grown up in the country and was used to such sounds. The frequency of the cracks increased. Someone's going crazy with that whip, Ida Orton thought. She glanced back at her own house and heard a fizz past her ear. Then one of the terracotta tiles on her roof shattered. She realized someone was shooting at them from the bottom of the street near the Gardner house. Ida and Rob grabbed the kids, ran into the house and lay on the floor. They heard intermittent volleys for the next 3 hours that broke windows and streetlights in Acacia Court and Hyacinth Street. When Brian Murphy started his night shift at 9:30 p.m, the siege was still going on. Over the radio, the D-24 dispatcher suggested he take a look, as a stalemate had developed. Peering over the windowsill of her front room, Ida Orton could see a dozen police cars parked here and there. The street was cordoned off and officers were creeping through the neighbouring gardens, guns drawn, trying to get a clear view of the Gardner place. The gunman was in the front bedroom, propped on the windowsill to watch the street, his .22 caliber rifle at the ready. He commanded an extensive field of fire. From his house on the corner, high on the hill, Hyacinth Street dipped away steeply, putting a dozen homes in his direct sight. Corporal Jim Gardner was only 33, but already he felt like an old man. He joined up in 1966 and was sent to Vietnam in June 1969 with the 110 Signal Squadron. He spent his tour at Vong Tau Back Beach, where signalers operated a major communications hub for the war. Information on his war service is sketchy, but it appears he left Vietnam in October 1969 after falling ill. He came home bitter and disillusioned, just as public opinion was swinging heavily against the war. Like many vets, he wondered how he'd survived and why so many Australians hated him for it. He stayed in the army on his return and was attached to the 6th Signal Branch at Watsonia Barracks in Melbourne. He had a wife and two young children, but depression and perhaps undiagnosed post-traumatic stress had pushed him to the edge. Over a period of months in small amounts, he'd stolen $1,800 from the army mess at Watsonia. He feared he'd be exposed and court-martialed. Earlier that day, he'd tried to commit suicide with a rifle in the hills behind the Healesville training camp, but was interrupted. He returned home in an agitated state after several hours of drinking. His wife, Joy, was babysitting for some neighbours across the road. Jim came to her with his rifle in hand and told her that an intruder was prowling inside their house. At 6:30 p.m, the firing began from inside the Gardner's home, and his wife called the police. Corporal Gardner was making his last stand. When Murphy arrived, he saw as many as 20 officers taking cover behind their vehicles as Gardner took potshots, blowing out the headlights of the police cars. He ordered every light in the street be turned off, and then, through the darkness, Ida Orton saw a lone figure stand up from behind cover. "Jim, I want to talk to you," she heard Murphy say. "Get fucked! Any closer and I'll put one through you," shouted Gardner, looking through the rifle sights at Murphy. Hey, Jim, just give me a chance," said Murphy confidently. "I'm coming to talk to you. I won't be armed. Just want to talk to you, mate." He handed his gun to his partner, Griff Morris. "I'm going over, but if he shoots me, kill the bastard with my gun, would you, Griff?" Morris had the heart of an ox. He would follow orders. Murphy approached the house up the sloping front lawn. Ida could hear him pleading with Gardner in the most plaintive, compassionate tone she'd ever heard. "Jim, come on, put down the gun. You want to see your kids again? I want to see my kids again. Please, Jim, I'm begging you. Please put down the gun." She watched him edge his way right to the house and then up the stairs to the front door. He sat on the rail. To his right, 12 feet away, Gardner sat on the windowsill of the front bedroom, the rifle trained at Murphy's head. Murphy pulled out his tobacco and tried to roll a cigarette, but his hands were shaking so badly he couldn't manage it. "Hey, Jim, can't seem to roll a smoke with you pointing that thing at me. Why don't you give me one of yours?" asked Murphy. "Well, you'd be a mean bastard, wouldn't you?" said Jim, rolling your own. "Make one yourself." "I would, but I'm shitting myself," said Murphy. Gardner laughed, lowered the rifle, and tossed over a cigarette from a packet in his shirt pocket. Murphy resisted the urge to lunge over and pull Gardner off the window. "Hey, I know what, Jim. Let me come in. We'll have a talk about this." "If you have a gun or handcuffs, I'll kill you, you understand," said Gardner. "Sweet, sweet. Just let me in." Gardner opened the door and pushed the rifle straight into Murphy's mouth, forcing the muzzle between his lips. Murphy could feel the warm steel of the recently fired weapon on his tongue. The front gun sight scraped the roof of his mouth. With one hand, Jim frisked Murphy up and down, and satisfied he was unarmed, pulled him inside. "What about a cuppa?" Murphy suggested jauntily, his legs shaking as they walked into the kitchen. Still holding the rifle, Gardner put on the kettle. His wife had made a hedgehog cake, and he offered some, but Murphy refused. His mouth was so dry with terror he couldn't swallow. Gardner's anger flared again. "What? Are you crooking me, missus?" he snarled. "No, no, give us some of that cake," then Murphy said, taking a piece and trying to eat it. It stuck to the roof of his mouth, and he blew crumbs when he tried to speak. He had to get inside this man's head, or neither of them would walk out of there alive. "Jim, no matter what's gone on, your kids and your wife, they love you," said Murphy. "And no matter what you've done, we can't hang you and we can't deport you. So already you're way in front. And you know what, Jim? If you kill me, my kids will be terribly disappointed because I'm supposed to be taking them fishing tomorrow." "How many kids have you got, mate?" asked Gardner. 5, said Murphy, running through the names and ages. "Well, I've only got 2, said Gardner, sighing. They talked about their kids and the burden of fatherhood. It was sometimes hard to live up to the man his kids thought he was," said Murphy. "Life was full of mistakes, disappointment and sorrow, but a child's love was unconditional. There would always be forgiveness." Soon the corporal was crying, saying he'd made a mess of everything for his family. "But there was always time to begin again," Murphy said. "Redemption could begin right there." Then, quite unexpectedly, Gardner unloaded the rifle and laid it on the floor. There was no talk for a moment, just the sound of Gardner's crying. Murphy never made a move towards the gun. They began to talk about everything that had happened, from Vietnam until that moment. Gardner told Murphy a story of seeing innocent civilians killed in urban attacks, and of seeing the aftermath when a vehicle carrying American and Australian troops had hit a landmine. Compared with others' experiences, what Gardner had witnessed had seemed minor. But somehow, he'd taken on the guilt of the survivor. He'd walked away uninjured, while so many others had died. "He should have gone too," he said. "His life was worthless." Soon after Gardner arrived home at Christmas 1969, he attended a function at Sydney University. Officers had warned veterans not to wear their uniforms on campus to avoid antagonizing the students, but Gardner was too proud to go in his civvies. The students spat on his uniform, called him a baby killer, and he never forgot it. Everything in his life was wrong. The system was against him, picking on him. "Everybody lives by the system. You can't buck it," Murphy told him. "What's affected you is something that happens to perhaps 1 in 100,000 people. You are special." "Don't fucking give me special," said Gardner. "Whatever you think you are or not, you are special," said Murphy, fixing him with a stare. "How many other blokes have survived in a war zone, got back here, and have a wife and children that love them?" Murphy promised he would make sure Jim was well treated if he came out and gave himself up. Shortly after 11 p.m, the Ortons watched the two men walk out of the house and to the waiting policeman. "That was the longest 20 minutes of my life," said Murphy, when he got back to his partner, Griff Morris. "Murph, you're in there for over an hour and a half," said Morris, handing him back his gun. The next day, Murphy, through his contacts, arranged for the National Bank to extend Gardner a loan to cover the money missing from the army mess. Gardner later pleaded guilty to using a firearm to prevent arrest. Judge Byrne of the county court released him on a $50 three-year good behaviour bond. On Murphy's evidence, it was clear, the judge said, that Gardner would not re-offend and therefore he would not jail him. He'd been diagnosed with psychotic depression. It is plain to see in this case the sheer unselfish bravery of Detective Murphy, the judge said. He put your welfare before his own life. The following September, Murphy was awarded the Victoria Police Valour Award for outstanding courage, restraint, and devotion to duty. Murphy received the Valour Badge on the 21st of September 1976 on the parade ground at the Glen Waverley Police Academy. As he pinned the badge on Murphy, a Deputy Commissioner, J.R.G. Salisbury, began to laugh. "Well, look at you, Brian Francis Murphy. It wasn't so long ago we were trying to pin a murder on you, and here we are pinning a Valour Badge on you." "Funny how things turn out, isn't it?" Murphy replied. In May 1978, Murphy was on interchange duty in Perth when he received a call from a bank manager in rural New South Wales. He told Murphy that Jim Gardner had taken his own life at home with an overdose of sleeping pills. "Get fucked," Murphy said in disbelief and hung up the phone. Whenever I talked to Brian about that day, he would well up in tears. This was one of the hardest things in his career to accept, that after all that work and all that risk, Jim Gardner still took his own life. We talked about it a lot, and the fact that his bravery had given Gardner some more time with his wife and kids. They couldn't save him. Perhaps no one could save him. But that's what the police officer does, puts himself in harm's way for the sake of others. And Brian Francis Murphy, you did that. Always proud of him. We'll always love him. Murph, you're as good as gold. Thanks, mate.